Case number 22-1338, Drew Parsons versus City of Ann Arbor, Michigan, et al. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Bender, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. Mark Bender on behalf of plaintiff appellant Drew Parsons. If I may, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Great.
As the court is aware, this case arises from a summary judgment for the defendant in a case brought under Section 1983 alleging the use of excessive force by the officer. There is a video. I suspect the court has had a chance to review it. It is, I think, helpful to everybody to be able to see with their own eyes what was shown by the cams. But what I would like to stress,
as far as you're concerned, are there any disputed facts? I mean, does the video combination of videos shows everything?
Well, there are disputed facts regarding, for example, what had occurred inside the bar, what the officer saw, what the plaintiff was doing, but the exact moment of the injury is depicted in the video.
But with regard to what happened inside the bar, I mean, there's no dispute that when the officer got on the scene, somebody from the bar told him that the gentleman was being escorted out and had struck the bouncer, right? He had hit the bouncer.
Yes, that's
right. And so regardless of what happened before that, I think as far as the defendant is concerned, that's what he knew, right?
That's true, but the background I'd like to bring in, though, is that under the case law, for example, what was the crime? That kind of goes before the injury itself, because there was nothing approaching a crime other than arguable resistance that occurred in the officer's presence.
Did he punch the bouncer according to what was told to him, or just kind of resisted coming out the door?
According to the bouncer, the plaintiff was no longer combative by that time.
But he was before he came out the door? They wouldn't have pushed him out if he wasn't carrying on, right?
No, there had been something that occurred inside the bar. There was not a very good description of what happened, but he was being escorted out, no question about it.
I thought from the tape that there's the manager and the bouncer, and one of those told the officer that Mr. Parsons had hit the other.
I think knacked was the word.
And what?
Knacked, I think.
Knacked?
Knacked was what he was told. But yeah, there's no question.
But the officer was told that at least that either the bouncer or the manager had been knacked, whatever.
There had been.
Whatever word it. Conclude that knacked means, but
in the not too distant past,
yeah,
the plaintiff had struck the bouncer. No question about that.
And there's no law that says that the striking would have to be, you know, constitute a felony. I mean, it could very well be a misdemeanor under the Graham factors or otherwise, right?
Well, the cases have looked, for example, one of the Graham factors is the severity of the crime. And certainly misdemeanor felony is one way of weighing the comparative severity of the crime. In this particular case, we have the bouncer saying, he struck me, wasn't a big deal, didn't hurt, I wasn't going to prosecute him, that sort of thing. So yeah, there had been contact, but I think that it's strange thing a bit for the trial court to call that violent. But in any event, the important part about that, I think, is that this was past history. What the officer saw with his own eyes is a plaintiff who was not combative was being escorted out of the bar by the two bouncers. If you look at the tape, you can see apparently an exchange between the plaintiff and bouncer, but nothing more than that.
Let me ask you this. The interaction between the officer, Officer Kant, and Mr. Parsons, the video seems to show that Mr. Parsons grabbed the officer's wrist. Is there a dispute as to whether that happened?
I don't recall looking at the video that it was an actual grabbing of the wrist.
Okay.
What I did see is the officer grabbing Mr. Parsons, and in fact, he seems to have been under the direct physical control initially of the bouncer. And at the time of the injury, the officer himself had his hands and arms locked in when he took him face first to the concrete. So I don't think that the video shows him resisting in any fashion. What he did do is delay putting his hands behind his back, although he eventually complied with that. And some of the cases from this court, including the Shoemate court.
When you say he eventually complied with that, are you saying before he was taken down?
Oh, yeah.
Because it seems like he pulls up from the car, I mean, momentarily, but it doesn't look like, look, the officer clearly wants to handcuff him, and it doesn't seem to me that he's standing there and saying, okay, here are my arms, he says to him several times, put your hands behind your back, whatever it is, and I don't know that that's...
As I look at it, he had his hands behind his back, agreed that it took some time, a couple, 5 seconds maybe, I don't know. He eventually puts his arms behind his back. The officer is able to lock in those arms because as he takes him down face first, the officer's holding his arms back so he can't protect himself. And so he is in that control from the outset, really. And the suggestion that he was a flight risk or attempting to flee, I think, is not depicted. And as I understand the video, he rises up from having his face on the hood and rotates his body without, I don't think, even stepping anywhere. This was not a case where he was fleeing, which is, of course, one of the Graham factors, nor was he resisting arrest. At best, he was slow to put his hands behind his back, but that isn't resisting arrest or fighting or anything of that nature.
Were the handcuffs on when he turned around, as you say, back toward the officer?
I don't believe that he was ever handcuffed. I think his hands were back and the officer kind of had his arms around him, but he was not handcuffed.
Never handcuffed, okay. What's your best case out of the Sixth Circuit to show that qualified immunity is not applicable here?
They're cited at pages 20 and 21, but there are several cases that involve what I would call face plants that hold that under the circumstances that is excessive force. Now, obviously,
you have one real good case.
Shoemate, I think.
Which one?
Shoemate is, I think, the strongest case and the most recent one. In terms, and if you look at that case, the verbal resistance by the plaintiff in that case was far greater than what we have in this particular case. So ultimately, the other point I'd like to stress is that cases say when you have a video that is subject to alternative reasonable explanations or interpretations, for a summary judgment motion you have the same standard of light most favorable to the plaintiff. So the existence of the video itself, if it is ambiguous, is something that is to be viewed favorably to the non-movement plaintiff as well. I think the rest of it has pretty much been covered in the briefs, although I'm happy to address any additional questions the court may have.
No, you can reserve the rest.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Matt Thomas for the appellee, Justin Kantz, et al. I would agree with counsel that, you know, this case has, you know, the video clearly shows all the relevant portions of the incident. I would disagree that, you know, that's open to reasonable interpretation. As I disagree that there are gaps in the video, as counsel has stated, but I think the key facts here are, and this is all clearly shown on the video, you know, Officer Kant arrives on scene at a very busy bar. He sees, and obviously, you know.
I mean, what, I guess the question for me is really, I mean, what is the level of resistance here? There's no real verbal resistance, right? He's not saying, no, I'm not going to do that, you know, et cetera, et cetera. He is not quick to put his hands behind his back, and he, I think, pops up a little bit from the car. Is that enough? I mean, is that active resistance? Is he given enough time to even comply with the verbal commands before he gets taken down? I guess that's my...
Yeah. As cited in our brief, the Rudloff case defines active resistance as refusing to move your hands for a police officer to handcuff you, at least if that inaction is coupled with other acts of defiance. I think here there clearly are. You know, as the district court recognized, Sergeant Kant gave plaintiff three commands to place his hands behind his back. You can clearly see here on the video, you know, plaintiff saying, you know, wait, really, you know, recognizing that the commands are being given. As Judge Cole recognized, you know, the video clearly shows plaintiff grabbing Sergeant Kant's wrist. Sergeant Kant, in both the police report immediately after the fact and in deposition, said that he felt plaintiff tensing his arms, which is why he placed him on the hood of the car, gave him the fourth command to place his hands behind his back. Plaintiff, you know, then placed his hands behind his back, you know, began to comply with the order to place his hands behind his back, again, clearly recognizing that the order was being given. But then, as noted, you know, he pushes off the hood of the car. He takes his hands from behind his back, pushes off the hood of the car, and turns towards the open road. And as Sergeant Kant said, again, in the police report and depositions, he felt his, you know, plaintiff's body weight moving towards the road.
I think that's sufficient to allow the officer to take him down because he turned around?
Sure. You know,
didn't put his hands behind his back?
Well,
he did put them behind his back, but not, I mean, he didn't keep them there.
Right. He didn't. Not only did he not keep him there, he pushed off the hood of the car and turned his body away from the officer. Under the Graham factors, you know, looking at the first two Graham factors of, you know, a reasonable suspicion of a violent crime being committed, you know, the nature of the scene being, you know, busy. And
does it matter that it's not really a violent felony? I mean, what would it be? What crime would he have been?
It would have been, you know,
hitting somebody. I mean, like a misdemeanor battery or what?
Well, sure, it would have been a misdemeanor assault, probably. I mean,
it's violent. I mean, he struck somebody, but is that what we're?
Case law is there's no clear case law saying, you know, violent crime means force, nonviolent crime means non-force. It's, you know, kind of a multi-factor situation. I think the key thing here is, you know, given the plaintiff's clear intoxication level, you know, the fact that he had already struck a bouncer, you know, means that the officer is reasonable to believe that this is kind of an unpredictable person, could be violent, you know, just, and, you know, combined with the jerking off the hood of the car, you know, is it yet another unpredictable thing that Officer Kant faced in the situation? And as the case law says, you know, there's no 20/20 hindsight here. So spending time thinking about what the bouncer told another officer later in the day, or later, you know, 20 minutes later, all that's relevant in the reasonableness standard is whether or not it was reasonable for an officer in Officer Kant's situation, knowing what he knew at the time, to think that the force was reasonable to control plaintiff.
Your opponent says that the Shoemate case pretty much gives him a right to bring a trial. Why is that not correct?
Well, sure. Unsurprisingly, I would disagree with that. The Shoemate case, the plaintiff was responding to, I believe his daughter was the one who had been pulled over, and the car was going to be impounded. So the officer told, you know, plaintiff to call someone to pick her up for a ride. So the plaintiff ended up getting the confrontation with the officer, wasn't suspected of any crime. I think the court there said the only thing he was really even guilty of was kind of interfering with the inventory search of the car. You know, there was only verbal back and forth. It was just an argument. There had been prior history with the plaintiff and the officer, and the use of force there was more significant. I mean, I believe he used a taser 2 or 3 times on plaintiff in that case, with no, you know, physical. There was no physical interaction between plaintiff and the officer, so I don't think it's on point at all here.
So the big action here is that the bouncer said that he'd been struck by the plaintiff, mm-hmm. and that makes it different from Shoemake, right? Is that what you're saying, or is there something I missed?
No. Well, yeah, that's correct. You know, the plaintiff here was suspected of a underlying crime, you know, outside of just interfering with an investigation. You know, again, it goes into the grand factors of what does officer can't understand the situation to be. How does he judge the person that he's trying to control? You know, he's attempting to investigate an alleged assault. And again, given plaintiff's intoxication, the visible signs of intoxication, the fact that he's, you know, already told, you know, as Sergeant Cannon is walking up to the door, the bouncer, you can see this on the video, is, you know, has two hands physically controlling plaintiff. So, you know, taking all that into consideration with Sergeant Cannon's understanding of the situation, understanding of plaintiff, you know, I think it's reasonable for him to believe that he's unpredictable. And then once he doesn't comply with the orders and then starts to comply, but then again jerks off just as to the unpredictability. And as, you know, Sergeant Cant said, he felt like the body was headed towards the road. He thought he was going to flee. So that's when he employed the takedown.
Why wouldn't there be, you know, sort of a less severe action that could have been taken by the officer? You know, he took him down, and apparently Mr. Parsons, well, clearly his face hit the ground and he had some injuries. Isn't there sort of like a less severe action that could have still controlled Mr. Parsons? I don't know, maybe pushing him back down in the hood of the car or whatever. I'm just wondering, I guess.
Yeah. And that was covered in Sergeant Cant's deposition. You know, he testified that he was attempting to employ what he called a straight arm takedown, which would have been able to guide plaintiff down to the ground, you know, in a more controlled way. But because of, you know, the body positioning, the, you know, body tensing, momentum, you know, he wasn't able to, you know, perfectly carry out the straight arm takedown. And he ended up, you know, slamming him with more force than he intended to. But, you know, certainly there would be, you know, he's attempting to take him down in a more controlled way, and he has failed to do so because of, you know, the situation. And again, as case law has indicated, you know, these are very, you know, bang-bang situations with rapidly evolving situations where, you know, things don't always come out perfectly, so. I think, you know, unless Your Honors have any other questions for me, I think that covers the points. No.
Great, thank you. Thanks. We'll hear rebuttal.
Thank you. The question was raised about the level of resistance. The specific Graham factor is resisting arrest or evading arrest by flight. In this particular case, the officer recognized that he wasn't attempting to arrest the plaintiff. He was investigating. Nothing had occurred in his sight that would create a crime. And the plaintiff, he didn't indicate to the plaintiff that he was under arrest or anything else, which is another factor, I think, mentioned in some of the case law. But he certainly wasn't resisting arrest because there was no arrest, nor was he evading arrest by flight. I don't think he even took a single step in the entire time he was under the physical control of the officer. The other question...
Was he under physical control of the bouncer before, as he came through the door?
Yes.
And then the bouncer, did he turn him over to the defendant or just turn him loose?
Pretty much. I think the officer kind of said, come over here, or got him, or something of that nature. But in any event, he went from being in the physical control of the bouncer with another bouncer or employee next to him to the officer. And at that point, the officer said, hands behind your back, face to the hood, and then eventually had him by the arms when they went down. But he certainly wasn't resisting arrest or fleeing to arrest, to avoid arrest.
Was he real vocal to the officer or didn't say anything?
Pardon me?
Was your client vocal to the officer, like calling him names or the bouncer calling him names?
I don't think there's any testimony that he said anything. If you look at it, he's apparently a confused, drunk college student from out of state who is sort of in a cloud
place.
About
it. He's in the wrong place.
He was in the wrong place at the wrong time, I guess. But if it had not been for the officer, what they were planning on doing is saying, go home and sleep it off. And that's what his girlfriend was pleading with the officer to do. The other Graham factor that I think warrants stressing is whether he is an immediate threat to officers or others. It certainly wasn't anything immediate. In fact, the only thing that of a physical nature was past history. And when you're talking about the severity of the crime, it seems to me that that's kind of a shorthand for saying, is this a person that the police have reason to believe is an extraordinarily violent person who requires more force than sort of a typical arrestee? But it's not license to punish, if you will, someone for what they had done in the past. And that's why I think it's important to look at the severity of the crime in that light. And in this case, not only do you have what we consider not a severe crime, but we're talking about past history when the bouncer says he wasn't combative at all coming out. And frankly, he wasn't combative at all once he was in the officer's hands. So in sum, we're asking the court to reverse.
Well, the officer had to ask him three times, I think, maybe a fourth time, to put his
hands
behind his back. So he was not initially compliant, right? I mean,
correct.
That's pretty clear.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Case will be submitted.